This is Wage War, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around?
Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like. They're living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on these websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Sean Richmond, who is currently he's the program director at the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College, but he has been a former union organizer, and he's written a book called Tell the Bosses We're Coming, New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Welcome to Wage World, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, a pleasure. Well, I don't need to tell you, but who knows about the listeners? I enjoyed reading your book. Anytime something agrees with me, and at least 50% of the time, I'm a happy man. And better than that, I'm ecstatic. And, I could see it coming towards the end. Now, before we get hard into it, it seems like you spent some time in New Orleans as well.
I did. And I write about one of the campaigns that you're probably very familiar with at the Benjamin Franklin Charter High School, the first charter school in New Orleans to successfully form a union. You were at the school board hearing where the school board was taking testimony on why the workers wanted to have a union.
I graduated from Franklin High School, and I had a very mixed feeling about that entire experience. So I can't tell you how much I enjoyed going back and sort of sticking the pin in them and saying, hey, not all this stuff, it's the teachers that make a difference here, not the building or the... You know, now they're a charter, so it's donors and everything else. But it's good to see Franklin lead in a good way for a change. I mean, it wasn't the first time, but we were the first high school to be integrated in the city back when I was in high school there. So, yeah, Sean, you were an organizer for the AFT then, but you also spent time with Unite HERE, right?
With the Local 6 in New York. That's where I cut my teeth. It was a very interesting experience. In fact, actually, I'm currently working on a book that's sort of a prehistory of that union, because that union can trace its roots back to an IWW strike in 1913. There was a series of independent unions that organized in New York's hotels. And so, you know, there was a period where it was a communist union, and I didn't know it at the time, but my training is comes directly from this oral history of wobbly tactics, of CP tactics. The structure of the union is actually it's William Z. Foster's Stockyards Labor Council.
Wow.
and so here's this amazing history hiding in plain sight, and really, you know, it sort of helped me understand who I am. I learned from these unions that, you know, I mean, I say in the book that one of the problems with labor is that we strive for consensus, but that doesn't work at a time when the solutions aren't obvious, you know, and actually what we need is a little bit more fruitful disagreement. And so, you know, I learned from these, this union that sort of stands out as being a little bit different than the rest of the labor movement in New York, being a little bit different than the rest of Unite here, being a bit of a pain in the butt for that reason. But it was a union where we had a no strike clause in the contract. And I talk about no strike clauses in the book as being, I think, one of the things that's really holding us back. But we figured out ways to, you know, we'd have lobby meetings.
Sure.
and all the work would stop for the day, you know, and we got our point across, and we just need a little bit more of that in the labor movement, you know, like, don't, we shouldn't be guaranteeing bosses 5 years of labor peace. They're not earning it.
No way. I mean, I, of all the contracts I've bargained, I only had one that didn't have a no-strike clause, and it didn't take more than 6 or 7 years before I had them begging me for one. But, you know, I once read a history of HERE that doesn't quite tell the story of that of Local 6, because its vision was a barman strike or something like that in New York City. It was one of those official union histories.
Yeah. The official. Believe me, I have a totally bookmarked copy of that book.
I still have it in my library.
Hiding the history in plain sight. I mean, he'll put things that happened over the course of 5 years in a paragraph just to sort of like, let's not talk about that commie period. You know?
Well, we're going to get more to your book, but I got to tell you a story about your New York local. We won. The first election at a hotel in New Orleans in 1981, the Hyatt Regency.
Wow. Sure.
In a bitter fight. They wouldn't even let us vote on premises. We had to, the labor board folks had us literally hike 3 or 4 blocks to where their office was at that time to vote because the Hyatt wouldn't let us tally the votes there. They appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court or whatever. So I finally get to bargaining. I'd never bargained a hotel contract. So, you know, you get a copy of the one from New York and a copy of the one from San Francisco. So it was one of the first contracts I ever bargained. We're talking 40 years ago.
Yeah, right.
And so I had a wish list there. I mean, the Hyatt attorney said we had 144 sessions. He would count every 2 hours as a session. And I swear to God, the first 100 was just him moving me back to reality from the New York and Vegas San Francisco.
Right.
No, I had sugar plums in my head. And, if I heard the word
accretion.
If I heard the word non-compensable time one more time, I was going to cut my own wrist. But I often say I got taught how to bargain the hard way in that contract. Look, this book is sort of a different twist, but it deals with the issue of collective bargaining and how perhaps that hasn't worked out as well for unions as we might have hoped.
Well, I mean, we're caught in this trap, right? Like, I mean, even I could go on and on about the trap, right? Even the one contract that you had that didn't have a no-strike clause. You know what? The bosses could take that contract to court, and judges are going to say, well, it's implied because you have an arbitration clause in the contract.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, these union contracts were, you know, they used to be 1 year peace deals. This is this year's wages, you know, this is this year's hours, and we won't strike for the terms of this 1 year deal. And they've turned into these longer term, you know, it's sort of like a workplace government, and we need workplace governments. But, you know, other countries separate out the functions of the workplace government and the function of a union, which acts more like a political party within the system, right? In Germany, you have this works council where you're guaranteed that there's going to be representation, that there's a process for grievances, that you have a right to your job. That all happens on day one. There's no election to make that happen. The employer can't secede from that system like they can around here in this country. And then you have multiple unions competing in the workplace based upon ideology, based upon, you know, who can get along better with the boss, based upon who can make the boss's day a little bit worse, you know, depending on what the workers want to do that year, you know, at their job. And here, the onus is on the union to guarantee this labor peace that the employers are just not interested in. They violate it constantly. They can subcontract the jobs. The best you can do is bargain over the impact of that decision, not the decision itself. You know, you get to the bargaining table, and on day one, your health insurance is there, and the boss is asking for concessions. Employer-based health insurance is absolutely one of the things that's holding unions back from growing. I think that we need a little bit more experimentation with what a union in the workplace looks like, and particularly at non-union workplaces, and particularly in industries where there's not a union that's seriously organizing. So I'm thinking of tech, I'm thinking of Amazon fulfillment centers, And the workers are organizing in those industries, and they are they know that the system is a trap, and so they're very consciously not, you know, they're not going to go for an NLRB certified union election. It's not worth it for them. They'd much rather figure out how to engage in protest actions that will get the boss's attention and get them, you know, some of what they want to win.
Well, and the size of the units are massive and in
yeah,
tech
right.
As
it goes
well,
around the world. So what law would even apply when you got workers in London, Bangalore, you know, LA, Seattle?
No, it's be a difficult situation. I mean, it's the same problem we had in Walmart or whatever. I mean, you're going to really organize 2,500 stores? Not in this century. If you went to the NLRB route, you have to go with a different strategy.
Right.
But it is, we're talking to Sean Richmond about his new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming. Sean, one of the points that certainly hit home in my view is this whole problem of exclusive representation where of course, in many states, and I'm sitting here in Arkansas right now and on my way back to Louisiana in a couple of hours, and those are all right-to-work states, as are almost half now of the country, which means we have the burden of representing everybody, including free riders, and we're forced to also defend the contract. You know, without a contract, and you make this point as well about collective bargaining, when I represent school workers in Houston, if we get the wages up to $13 an hour recently, which we were able to do, $14 an hour actually, I can still go back the next day to the school board and say, that's not enough, you know?
Right.
But if
right.
I bargain a contract at ResCare Healthcare and get, you know, get 50 cents, I've got to act like that's the best thing in the world.
Right.
Even if the workers had wanted us to, you know, get a dollar. Both of those are a problem.
I absolutely agree. So agency fee in non-right-to-work states, the ability of a union to charge a fee to everybody, regardless of whether they join the union or not, that has its roots in World War II. And I, you know, in the run-up to the Janus case, I was really trying to call attention to this. You know, I actually got a thing published in the Washington Post. You know, I was hoping to scare the bejesus out of John Roberts. Like, do you really want to do this? Because what happened is unions, you know, unions pledged not to strike for the war, right? Because we wanted to beat the fascists. Out of an act of patriotism, they said, we're not going to strike. And then the War Labor Board went and said, well, you know, in order to get inflation under control, we have to freeze wages. And the price of milk was going up, but the wages weren't. And workers were deeply frustrated and doing wildcat actions. And the union had to send their representatives down, and they have to talk people back onto the job. And it got to the point where workers were asking, why the hell do I have a union? You know, you can't raise my wages, you know, and you're telling me I can't go on strike. And they started quitting the union in protest. And it was becoming such a problem that there was a real chance that the unions were going to break the no-strike pledge because they just, you know, they were losing their membership. They had to show efficacy. And so the War Labor Board said, you know, gave them this sort of maintenance of membership formula that evolves into agency fee. And we've lost sight of this totally within the labor movement. When we talk about agency fee, too often we talk about the expenses that a union incurs in the act of having to represent everybody in the bargaining, the expenses of filing grievances, the expenses of going through the collective bargaining process. And that's not what agency fee is for. Agency fee is for the political expense of signing a contract, going out there and defending it as the best we can do to the members, and then enforcing the terms of a no-strike clause for the duration of that contract. And so if the bosses want to tear that system apart, they deserve the chaos that they're begging for, and that is for us to say, you know, or to at least experiment with situations where we don't, you know, we're not going to do the exclusive representation thing. And so, I mean, I play with this thought a lot in the book because, you know, every time I say that, then everybody's like, but what does that look like? And so I play with a few scenarios of
that looks like the rest of the world, frankly.
It does, but, you know, we're Americans, so we're exceptional.
Yeah.
we're only going to compare ourselves to ourselves. But, you know, if you had a group of workers who took the logic of the Dick Janus decision and said, you know what, if you're making me be stuck in a bargaining unit under a contract and in a union that I don't agree with, that's politically coerced speech. And so, you know, I've got scenarios in there about, like, well, take the issue of paid family leave. Huge, huge issue to the minority of the bargaining unit that it briefly applies to. So it's one of those issues that in an exclusive representation framework, it almost never rises to the level of priority that you're going to win it. Right, because it's only for the parents, and it's only right. for the parents of kids under the age of five. In any bargaining unit, how many people is that?
Exactly.
So if a group of parents decided, you know what, we're going to form the parents' union at this workplace. We're quitting our union. We're forming our own union, and that contract's not good enough for us. We're going to continue to protest over the lack of paid family leave. How does the enforcement of the no strike clause is that it's for members of the bargaining, it's for members of the union, that the union has to go and say, look, you could be fired if you go on strike. If you have a group of workers saying, we're not a part of that union, we're in our own union now, and we are going to engage in job actions during the term of this contract. I'm not sure how that no strike clause is enforceable. I think that it raises huge constitutional issues, and more importantly, it just drives the boss nutty.
Well,
right?
But it also has the union representatives and leadership in a position of standing out in front of the workplace telling people not to strike.
Well, except, no, if it's a bunch of workers saying we don't belong to your union, the more sensible thing for the union to do, the easiest thing for the union to do is we can't control those people. They're not ours anymore. They quit us.
I know, but you also know the number of times that we get pulled into the labor board and everywhere else in arbitration because we supposedly didn't do enough to stop a wildcat.
Yes.
So that's what I'm saying. I mean, we would still see pictures in the paper of the poor union guy out there trying to keep workers from, you know, expressing a family leave demand.
Yeah, I think you might, but you would definitely have the union begging for some relief and pointing out very reasonably, how am I supposed to control somebody who refuses to join the union? You know, is in fact insisting that they're a part of a different union.
Right.
You know, if the whole system becomes untenable at that point.
No, it would be crazy, but another point you make in the book, and certainly I agree with this, is that let 1,000 ULPs fall, file unfair labor practices willy-nilly.
Yeah, that's specifically connected to a strategy that I've had hanging out there called Labor's Bill of Rights, which is, you know, partly it's an argument that unions have allowed the lawyers to be the last word for too long. Don't get me wrong, lawyers are important, but in organizing departments, particularly at the international unions, the lawyer gets to say,
the Knights of Labor knew what they were doing.
And
bankers
and
lawyers weren't allowed to be members. Yeah.
Yeah, I get where they're coming from, right? Because the courts are not our friends at all. You know, even Democratic judges are they don't know what it's like to work with your hands. You know, they just,
sure.
The lawyers it's a cautious strategy. Avoid the courts because we don't know what could happen and we could lose. Valid, totally valid. But that's also a strategy for losing slowly. Yeah, so it's a matter of that's a strategy for like controlling the speed of how much we lose. Whereas I think that there's an opportunity to win here because when you step back from the labor relations system, when you step back from Washington D.C. and you look at it, it's plainly unconstitutional. Take NLRB elections, right? This is an election that's being conducted by an arm of the federal government, the results of which will determine whether people have extra statutory protections that are going to be guaranteed. The rules of the election are that one party and one party only can force every voter into a mandatory presentation of their positions or be fired if they refuse to attend. And within that presentation, they can lie, they can threaten your job, they can hire somebody to impersonate a federal officer and lie about what your rights even are and what the process is. And crucially, it's not just that the party is only the boss, it's that the party is only a boss that advocates a no vote. If the boss actually got up there and said, hey, actually, you know, we think it's in your interest to join the union, that would also be illegal. When you step back from that, how is that not politically coerced speech? How is that not a massive violation of the First Amendment?
Well,
and I think we should be filing ULPs over it every time a boss does a captive audience meeting to make that argument.
Well, I mean, it's amazing to me how many people don't understand how ULPs work. I mean, I filed one against Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys for coercing his players that he would fire them for not saluting the flag or, you know, putting their hand over their arms or whatever if they during the Kaepernick situation. And, of course, it's perfectly valid for anybody can file ULP.
You don't need a lawyer.
That you recognize as an unfair labor practice. And eventually, you know, he backed off, so I was able to withdraw it. I mean, you know, I really was running 100% bluff. It's not like, you know, when they investigated it for the Fort Worth region of the labor board, I was able to sort of flannel mouth about, you know, yeah, I mean, workers don't want to come forward, but the union has filed this. And they were perfectly satisfied to investigate it fully. Contact the boss, and obviously Jones had to step back. But, I mean, we have a lot of tools we just don't use.
People have lost
the labor board sucks, and NLRA has been, you know, gutted, but we still have a couple of tools.
I mean, there's nobody keeps statistics on this, unfortunately. The NLRB doesn't keep statistics on how many charges are filed. I think that actually...
They used to.
I know. And they should again. That should be one of the basic things that a Democratic administration should do on day one. Because I think that a lot more charges are getting filed than we recognize. When I was doing the charter school work at AFT, anecdotally, I mean, in, I would say, about a quarter of the campaigns that I ran, we would wind up finding out somewhere along in the process that a worker had, that there's a pending ULP at that school because a worker had filed one in, just on their own. Huh. And, you know, the process takes so long. They filed it 2 years ago. And so when we have our own ULPs, because we started really running a campaign, the board agent would be like, oh, this place again? And you know, it would really help us in some campaigns. We got some elections overturned. We got, you know, we got some injunctive actions because there was a pattern of it because the workers were filing ULPs. Now, this might be a white-collar thing. It might just be bank tellers and charter school teachers that are filing ULPs. But it could be more than that. It could be McDonald's workers all over the country are filing ULPs. We just don't know. It's such a black box, and it's really frustrating.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you'd have to. I mean, they still make them, all the charges filed public in the book at the regional
office. Yeah, most get settled. If you're an individual worker who filed a ULP, that ULP is going to tend to have some sort of settlement.
Right.
So it doesn't get published.
We're talking to Sean Richman about his new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming. We're in the weeds a little bit on the union for some of our listeners, given low density of unions these days. But the other thing that I thought was interesting is you also argued that we should file appeals on every election that is lost.
Yeah, well, that's our pathway to get rid of captive audience meetings. The thing about captive audience meetings, which is what I just explained to your listeners about mandatory meetings, is so the National Labor Relations Act was written, it was intended to have employer neutrality. Right. It would be the assumption of the law was if workers decide they want a union, that's their choice. You stay out of it. And the bosses, of course, immediately went to the courts and said, hey, look, we have a First Amendment right to at least express our opinions. And of course, the courts agreed, right, because we lose in the courts a lot. But there was a period of time that the NLRB would apply different kinds of equal time standards because it's not natural that only the employer gets to use work time to say vote no. And so there were rules where, you know, if the employer started doing captive audience meetings, then union organizers would get access to the physical plant, and talk to workers in non-work locations and non-work times, but whatever. And so in 1966, the NLRB hands down two decisions. One is Excelsior Underwear, which that's how we get Excelsior List. That's where, you know, about, I don't know, exactly. 30 days out from an election, you get the names and addresses of the workers, right? And the second one was a case where the NLRB declined to bring back the equal time standard. And what they said in that decision is, look, we just issued this Excelsior decision earlier in the day. Try that. If that doesn't work, come back to us, and we'll reconsider. 1966. Did we ever come back and ask them to reconsider?
I know damn well we didn't.
We didn't. And any organizer who's worked with Excelsior List knows that they are no match for a captive audience meeting. And so the pathway, this is the Labor's Bill of Rights strategy. The pathway to getting back to some sort of equal time standard is every time the boss does a captive audience meeting, file a ULP and say we deserve equal access. And crucially, more so, you lose an election where they conducted a captive audience meeting, you appeal and you get the election overturned. The NLRB can issue a decision where that is the recourse. And so that bosses know, at a minimum, this is without even getting into the courts, at a minimum they know that a captive audience meeting could result in any election, adverse election result getting overturned. Exactly. I'm saying start filing them now. We've got a Trump labor board. There are no Democrats on the labor board. They're going to overrule us. But we should be making this an active controversy for the next Democratic labor board to deal with.
I hear you. You also, I would be remiss if I didn't let you talk about industrial wage boards, industrial boards for different industries, because that's something you advocate very strongly in this book.
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, it's sort of going back to the future. You know, before we had the National Labor Relations Board, we had the National Recovery Administration. You know, Roosevelt's whole thrust of his first New Deal was actually pro-corporate. Yeah, guys like you and me would not have supported Roosevelt. We would have hated him in 1932, 1933, even 1934. But, you know, crucially, it did include a right to organize that wasn't worth the paper it was written on. And I think we sort of forget this. We tell ourselves a very disempowering story of what labor, how labor reform happens, and it only happens if we somehow get the sit-down strikes going, if we only get the general strike. And that's not true. We got labor law reform when we were at our weakest point because Roosevelt just didn't need any more controversy around a bill that was very hard to get passed, and he worried about challenges to it. And again, not worth the paper it was written on, but it did just enough to raise workers' expectations and then dash their hopes that it actually got us a strike wave in 1934. And so I do think that that is a little bit of the future. But the Industrial Labor Board, it was not an exclusive model. It was, in the context of letting companies across an industry collude over prices, they also had to have a labor policy. They had to have labor codes that would apply across the board and essentially take labor issues out of bargaining. And, I'm reading this for the Hotel Workers Union. You know, it wasn't just HGRE that was at the table for this. It was also an anarchist union called the Amalgamated Food Workers. It was a communist union called the Food Workers Industrial Union. Every union that had a stake in the hotel trades got to the table and was able to sort of, make their case for what the labor code should be. Labor code wasn't good enough, and there was a strike in 1934. Now, what's interesting about that model, and what I think is very good for us, is it takes us out of the framework of the union having to defend a deal that's not good enough.
Right.
If it gets imposed on us by a labor board, we had our say, we did, we made what our wage demands were, we had our analysis of which companies were going to have the most influence on this, on the industry vote and on the public vote, because it's a tripartite system. You know, it's labor, the quote-unquote the public, and the company. And, to most union people, that sounds like two votes against one. And, yeah, it probably is two votes against one, unless you figure out who is, is it the Marriott Corporation if you're doing a hotel code? Is it the Hilton Corporation? Whoever it is, target them. And in hotels where you don't have, a contract with a no-strike clause, it caused some chaos. The code is developed, you get to step back and go, not good enough. But your workers still won something. It's a much better dynamic, I think.
And you still
not
have the chance
enough
to fight
we'll
for more.
Next year.
Exactly. We've been talking to Sean Richman about his book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Sean, how do people get a copy of this book?
So it's from Monthly Review Press. You could buy it directly from the publisher. Although, I hate this world that we live in. The statistics of how it's selling will turn out better if you get it from Amazon and give it a starred review. So depending on how much you want to help, those are your two options.
Okay, and that's Monthly Review Press and Amazon. We've been talking to Sean Richman about his book. We may have gotten in the weeds here, but despite the fact that union density is decreasing, workers in this time of pandemic depression probably need more organization than ever before. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wage World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wage World. Thank you.